Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. My guest tonight is G. Larry Butler, whom I'm sure many of you know. He's done many, many things. I couldn't even begin to mention them all. And the should be dialing soon.
Hello.
Hopefully. Hello, Larry. This is Mac. How are you?
Oh, very good, thank you. And you?
Oh, I'm doing just great. So you can hear me okay, right?
Yeah, right. Is the speaker okay, or do you want me to put the receiver in my ear?
Whichever way you want to do it is fine with me. It doesn't matter to me because I can
okay.
hear you fine. So as long as we can, as long as we can hear each other, we're on the air, so that's good.
Excellent. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
How's everything on the East Coast?
About the same as it always is. Like I like to say, SSDD. How about on the West Coast?
Oh, well, there's fires everywhere, and, we've had problems with pollution and, a downright fire, and I have to go to Oregon to do a film in 2 days, and that place is burning up, too, and it's a little scary, but I have to do it. So we had 3 locations, and two of them burned, so we have 1 left to shoot in, but wow. So it's been a heck of a year.
It's one for the record books, that's for sure. It's like, 2020, and I tell people, don't say that, because whenever you say what else can happen, that's when, stuff starts happening.
I promise I won't say that.
me either.
I know, I'm crossing my fingers and toes.
Yeah, I mean, just hopefully, it won't be anything too bad. That's all I'll say.
I know.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, the year's almost done, so hopefully we'll see the end of it soon.
And hopefully it won't go out with a bang.
I know,
so.
Literally.
That's why I said hopefully, because I don't want to jinx anything.
Sure.
So now, of course, I did some research on you, and even just from the little bit that I already knew before I did my research, I really can't do you justice in the small amount of time that we have, but I'll do what I can. And I do like to discuss some things that are interesting about, the person that's on the show. Like for you, I do want to say for myself and for my deceased father, who was a veteran. He was a captain in World War II. And I want to say thank you for your service, because I know that you did 3 tours in Vietnam.
Yes, I joined the Navy, and I didn't think I'd be sent over there, but to my surprise, I ended up in Da Nang, in country, as they say, on shore duty.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to protect the port of Da Nang, and so I protected the freighters that came in from all over the world with supplies, and I stood guard tours and road jeeps. I was in the security police force over there. And then I was sent back, and I did 1 tour in the States up in Eureka, California, at a very top secret base. I can't even talk about it. But then after that, went back to a ship in San Diego and went right back to Vietnam. And I thought, well, it can't be any worse than what I was dodging bullets the first tour, and it got even worse. So like you said, don't say it's all over, because it can get worse. We went all the way up to Hanoi, to the coast of China, and there's a lot of things that I shouldn't even talk about, but we did engage the enemy all the way up the coast, and we were the first ship in North Vietnamese waters, and they didn't expect us to come back. We found out later we were kind of a sacrificial lamb. They were trying to create an international incident, but we're kind of like Rambo, comes walking out of the jungle after everybody thinks he's dead, and we're still alive, but we got hit 36 times, blew our mast off, came limping in the port, spent 6 months in Manila, in Alangapo in the Philippines, in dry dock trying to get fixed up, and went back again for one more tour, and so it's quite a story. It's I don't want to, you know, take too long on that, but it's a part of my life. It was the early 70s, and it just it was a different time, and people didn't really appreciate what we did over there. But, you know, it's quite controversial even today. So, anyway, I have a lot of memories. I got PTSD, but I use it in my acting. I have very deep pools to pull things out of, you know, a lot of anxiety, neurosis, psychosis at times. I can pull a lot of rabbits out of my hat for my characters, and I don't need therapy anymore because I do it through my acting.
Oh, well, that's good. Good therapy for you.
Yes, yes. I actually, you know, did need therapy for a while. But now I don't anymore. I just use it through my work. I do a lot of acting, so I'm always creating a character and using some of the trauma that I experienced. And I even did a couple movies about Vietnam veterans with PTSD. One was called PTSD, and the other was a horror movie called Terror at Crimson Creek. It hasn't come out yet. But the other one is. So anyway, it's I'm kind of a method actor. I use real emotions in my acting, and when I taught acting classes, I told my students, feel it, don't fake it, because the audience will sense when you do fake things, and they'll pull back.
Right.
They won't enjoy your, you know, performance as much. So you know, it's kind of difficult, because if you feel intense emotions and use it, it kind of robs your memory. So you have to study doubly hard to, you know, memorize things. Because in theater, we used to put peanuts in our pocket, and we'd eat them before we came out on stage, because the nervousness that we felt would cause adrenaline to rob our memory banks. So it's an old theater trick. And I try to tell young directors this. If you're actor isn't memorizing correctly or not remembering their lines, feed them, especially protein. Protein neutralizes the adrenaline, and so it really works. And a lot of them don't want to hear it from an old-timer like me, but I tell them anyway, because they need to know. So anyway, I have a lot of tips for young directors. You know, sometimes they don't appreciate it when you tell them things. So I try to stay silent, but once in a while, I bring my own food to the set because I'm diabetic. And so I bring peanut butter, nuts, meat, cheese, eggs, anything with protein in it. It works well. And
Sometimes the youngsters will listen to the older folks, and sometimes they don't.
Right.
Yeah. Now that I'm 60, actually, it's been for a while now, because I've been considered old by somebody since I was 30.
I know.
You know how that.
I was in a bar once, and with somebody just turned 40, and I was kind of chuckling at him, and he turned to me, he said, "Just keep breathing, idiot. You'll get there." And sure enough, I'm 70, so I got there. No, I can appreciate it. You know? All the young people out there laughing at the older people, just keep breathing. You'll get there. And then you can relate.
Well, one of the things that I just posted on somebody else's wall, because they had posted something on Facebook about, you know, how they were upset because somebody was making fun of them, which, you know, I've been there, so I understand that. I used to get made fun of a lot for a bunch of different reasons. I wore glasses, because I was a little bit on the heavy side, because I wasn't considered a raving beauty. I was called ugly, all kinds of things.
Wonderful.
People really are wonderful. And it always hurt me so much up until my 20s. And then I started getting like this really thick skin. And now that I'm 60, I couldn't care less what people think about me.
Exactly.
You don't like the way I look? Don't look at me if you don't like the way I look. And I just want to say this one thing. I know it's your show, but this is funny, and I think you'll appreciate it. I was standing in line at a grocery store, and there was like 5 20-something guys behind me. And they were giggling and stuff, and the one says, "Hey, lady." So I turned around, and I said, "Yeah?" And he said, "You have a really big butt." And I think he thought that he was going to, you know, get me all flustered and I'd start crying or something. And it only took me 2 seconds to look him right in the eye, and I said, "Well, you must like big butts or something, or you wouldn't have been looking."
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah, the snappy reply, yeah. You could have made fun of his anatomy. You know?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You could have made fun of his anatomy. Usually people like that have small genitals. So,
Yeah, that's it usually ends up that way. But the greatest part of it was he got mad and he left. And then the other ones that were with him, they were apologizing to me. Because they said he's I know this is a PG-13 show, but I think it's okay to say dick. They said, "He's a dick." And I said, "Yeah, he is." And then they were just busting out laughing. But that's what got him mad and made him leave, was because his friends were laughing at him. They weren't
that's
laughing
right.
at me.
Miserable themselves. You know, the people I grew up with were miserable, so they wanted to inflict misery on me. And I was teased throughout elementary school and high school. I hated every minute of it. And so I learned later that people who don't fit in stand out later. So that was my choice to become an actor and stand out. Now when I go home, you know, they all treat me like I'm a celebrity or whatever, and it's just like, that's fitting revenge. I don't ask for it. They just do it. And it's just kind of ridiculous, I think. And the people that never left the small town, they're still doing the same job, making $10 an hour. And so I went off. I jumped the fence and went to the big city and, you know, did well. And so they're kind of eating crow now. But c'est la vie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it is. Oh, and sometimes you can get, not exactly revenge, but you can do like one of those. Because one time I had told one of my biggest bullies in high school, I said, "You know, you shouldn't be a bully to anybody, because one of these days you're going to be in the hospital and you're going to have a doctor or a nurse and it's going to be somebody that you bullied. And you better hope.
Yeah.
You better hope that they don't want revenge." And then I because I'm a nurse, I had them as a patient.
I know that
they remembered me telling them that, because they had this look of absolute terror on their face when I walked into the room and told them I was a nurse.
The big syringe, right? Right. Hey, bend over.
Actually, I had brought in a catheter, was what it was.
Oh, God, that's even worse. I can relate to that. Whoa. That's a man's nightmare.
They were here.
Yeah.
So I do want to go on to the next thing. Now, there's another thing I know about you that's interesting, because you're an accomplished climber. You climbed, whatever, to the summit of Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd always dreamt about climbing. I've read books about it. And, you know, I read a book by Aleister Crowley, which is, he's known as being satanic, but he was into black magic a little bit, but he was also a climber. So I was fascinated by his accounts of his climbing adventures, and I always read about Everest, and you know, and I was in Colorado for 11 years. And I climbed a lot of the mountains up there. They're all over 14,000 feet. I belong to the mountain club. And anything with adventure to it, I craved adventure. I'm kind of an adrenaline junkie. And so I climbed Whitney here, which is the tallest mountain in the lower 48, about 13 years ago with a friend of mine, Mount Whitney in California. And I thought, that's as far as I'm going to go. That's about 15,000 feet. And then, I don't know, I think I was talking to my doctor, and he mentioned that he'd climbed Kilimanjaro. But I forgot that he told me that. I just knew that somebody had. So it took a few years to percolate, and finally I decided, why not? You know, I'm about 68 years old, and I researched it, and I contacted them, and they said, okay, well, you're 68, and you have diabetes, and those are two factors that you got to consider. I wanted to do the 6-day climb, but they recommended that I take the 9-day. It was more circuitous, whatever you call it, and it took a little longer to get up there. But there were some very dangerous parts. We had to climb a wall, which is called the Barranca Wall, and you had to climb hand over fist to get through that section of it. And that's not the worst part. And I've done that. I used to climb mountains. I free climbed even before anybody knew what that was. I didn't use ropes. I never used ropes. I used to climb by myself, which is kind of idiotic, but I did. And I got in a couple scrapes early on. But anyway, I'll get back to the main focus here. Kilimanjaro. We started, I flew to Tanzania, and that's the country right next to Kenya. And I joined this group. There were supposed to be 12 of us, and there was only like 6 of us, I think. The party from New York that was supposed to be had to cancel at the last minute. So we had a pretty small group, so it was more intimate in that way. And we had about a dozen porters, the African people that were really strong, and they carried things on their backs and their heads. So we each carried 60 pounds on our backs. And the porters would carry about 100 pounds on their heads and their backs. It was amazing. It was just incredible to watch them work. And so each day we'd go about 6 or 8 hours of steady climbing. And we didn't do it fast. It was just 1 foot in front of the other. But the altitude made a big difference. One of our group had a bloody nose. It took a while to, stop. And I didn't get one. But my problem, everybody has a weak link, and you discover it later on. And mine was my lungs. So I got up to around 16, 17,000 feet, and my lungs seized up on me because I've had pneumonia before, living in Colorado. And so I have weak lungs. Not terribly weak, but, I mean, I have some weakness there. And so I had to wait a little bit. They went on. Some of them went on before me, some elite climbers. But I still made it. I made it to the top. It just took a little longer. And so it was very thrilling, but challenging at the same time. It was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And when I got to the top, you know, I took some pictures and stuff, and they told me, don't ever take off your dark glasses because you'll go snow blind, because there's still snow on top of Kilimanjaro. And another reason I wanted to climb was I'm quite a reader, and I was an English major for a while in college, and I read, I think Steinbeck wrote a book about the snows of Kilimanjaro, and I think it was Steinbeck. But anyway, I thought he'd climbed it, but actually he didn't. He just sat in a lawn chair and looked at it and wrote the story. When I found out, I was a little peeved, to say the least. But, you know, I would have climbed it anyway because I like a good challenge. It's a goal at my age. I just turned 71, and I'm going to climb Shasta next year. It's going to be an ice climb in Northern California. It's 15,000 feet, but it's more difficult because you have to do it with a pickaxe. You know, and I've never done that before, so it's a new challenge. And but anyway, I got to the top of Kilimanjaro, which is 19,000 feet. And the problem was You can take different routes up, and the one that I probably should have taken, the 6-day, you get up there in the morning. There's no cloud cover. But we got there, you know, around noon, and there was a lot of cloud cover, so we didn't have a view, which is unfortunate, because you can see into like 3 or 4 different countries from the top of that thing. It's the tallest mountain in Africa. But it was just a thrill to do it. And as soon as I got back down, I went and took a photo safari. I had just one guide, and we went all over and explored the inside of a volcano, extinct volcano, and it was so big that, you know, a lot of the animals live in there. And I saw the big 5, which is the water buffalo, the leopard, the elephant. There's 5 things that almost you can't ever see all 5, and I got to see all 5. I was very lucky. And So anyway, it was quite a thrill. I took a hot air balloon ride too, and the hippo is another one. They're the most dangerous, one of the most dangerous animals in Africa. But
sure.
I just love to climb, and I just keep doing it. I need a goal at my age, you know, to keep healthy. And so, oh, another thing, this is really odd. My porter told me, my personal porter told me that he had guided Harrison Ford to the top of Kilimanjaro a year earlier. And he said, if you ever see Harrison Ford, you know, everybody thinks we know the celebrities. And we don't, but I'd never met him. And he said, say hi to him for me. And so when I got back, I had this humongous beard. I let it grow. And so they hired me for Call of the Wild to play, this missionary. It was kind of a featured part. And so I didn't get to meet Harrison, but I got a note through production to him congratulating him on his climb. So we're kind of kindred spirits that way, I guess. And so he climbed it at 75. I was 68. So, you know, I figured if he could do it, I can keep going. So it was it's really a thrill to be able to do something like that. And just have to be careful, you know, and take your medication if you have any, because it'll get you that. Sheesh. So anyway, I'm just going to keep climbing. I've climbed a lot of mountains around Los Angeles, Mount Baldy and Whitney and some of the other ones, but they're not really that high. I wanted to climb Denali in Alaska. I haven't gotten around to it yet. I knew a guy that tried twice. He failed twice. He said, I wouldn't recommend it because you'll probably die trying. You know, a lot of people disappear up there because they fall into a crevasse and they can't get them out. And so that didn't really discourage me too much. I just haven't found anybody to go with me yet. My buddy, I climbed Whitney with his wife, told him he was too old to do it. He's 2 years younger than I am. So my wife didn't tell me that. I just went. So she lets me do what I need to do. So I really appreciate that. So, you know, everybody needs a passion in their life, you know, something to spur them on and live life to the fullest. And acting is one of them. I'm sorry I found it so late. I was 35 when I became an actor. People start very young, but I made up for it. You know, I did a lot of work. I hustled.
You did.
So I'm still doing it. So it seems like I'm doing more than ever now. But I just enjoy it so much. I like playing different characters and, you know, I think it's because I was teased so much, like you said you were, and I never really enjoyed being me, and so I wanted a chance to be other people. And I think Robert De Niro said that once. He said, I'm not comfortable in my own skin. I want to be in everybody else's. So it's nice to, you know, do that, inhabit somebody else's skin and play a different character and work out your demons that way. But I enjoy, the real reason that I do it is I took an acting class early on, and I looked around the room after this one particularly dramatic scene, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. I thought, this is how I want to affect people. Not to make them cry, but to make them feel, to make them think, you know, and whether it's to roll with laughter or to really be quite emotional with joy and sorrow and feel all those powerful emotions. Especially nowadays, a lot of people, the young people, they don't really think it's cool to feel. So they all wear a mask of indifference. But the older people can dip down into those reservoirs and express themselves. And so anyway, it's something I enjoy doing quite a bit.
Yeah, I like movies that make me feel something, whether it's, you know, happiness or sadness or anger or, you know, something.
We all need to,
Go ahead.
It's just that I love movies so much. I become part of them. I be immersed in them, and so I'm almost in a trance. And I used to go to theaters, but people would talk or, you know, just on their cell phones or so many distractions. And you try to go, shh, and they say, well, screw you. You know, it's like start a fist fight. I thought, I'm never coming back to a theater. So I haven't been to a theater in years. I just watch it on TV and my Netflix, but I can't be disturbed like that. So I think a lot of actors are that way. They really, if you're any good, you know, you're totally immersed in what's happening. And of course, we all watch it for different reasons. A director will watch a movie differently than an actor, and a producer as well. So it's like a prism. You see it from different angles. So,
right, and well, not one person is going to see it the same as another.
That's right, exactly. We all look at it for different reasons, from different angles, and have different opinions. And no two people will ever have the same opinion about, you know, what they see, which is healthy, you know, to have a debate or have an exchange. But anyway, I don't want to monopolize the conversation, so go ahead and tell me.
Oh, well, no. Not at all. I mean, you're the guest, so, you know, you're the one that should be doing most of the talking. But when you were talking about crying, I did want to mention this interesting tidbit that a lot of people don't know. You may or may not know who Henry Thomas is. I mean, you should know, because he was in E.T. playing Elliot.
Yes.
But when he was doing I can't even think of the word because I have a headache and I can't think when I have a headache. Screen test. He was doing the screen test for his part. And all of these people are watching, you know, producers, directors, and people that have seen, you know, everything in Hollywood. And the reason why he got the part was because when he was done with his screen test, there wasn't a dry eye in the room.
That's great.
And that's how he got his part, because he made these people cry that had seen everything,
right.
He made them cry.
Very good point. It's hard to do that. I relied on a trick. I'm glad you brought that up. I was telling somebody, I just did something yesterday, and I was with some young actors, and they were asking me, how did you get all these things? I said, well, John Madden used to be a sportscaster. And I don't know if you know the name, but he used to throw his script up. You know, he's big, bombastic, you know, kind of a blowhard type of guy, but, you know, I mean, very likable. And so I went in once, and I answered an ad for Jackie Gleason, who's one of my heroes. And let me just say that I'm quite a big actor, and I used to be big physically. I was a pretty heavy guy. And so I thought, I wonder how I'd stack up to all the guys in Hollywood. There's no chance I'm going to get this because everybody in Hollywood's going to come out for this role. They wanted not only a look-alike, but an act-alike. And I could imitate him really well, the way he moved his head and his whole body. And he's a very graceful man, but he kind of jerked his head a little bit. And he had certain ways of saying things. And I said, I got this. I could do it. So I get in there. As soon as I get in there, I had the copy, you know, cold. I memorized it. So I threw the script up in the air. It went all over the room. and I launch into my bit, and the director, who was the casting director as well, fell over in his chair. He was laughing so loud. And I went over to pick him up, and he said, "You're the funniest son of a gun I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I've got two guys coming for callbacks tomorrow, but screw them. You got the job." So I got cast on the first read. So I thought, hey, that works pretty well. So then I went for a Ford National. They wanted a spokesman, a guy who would break through the poster. I don't know if you probably – well, you might have remembered it. This guy – jumps through a poster, and he says, and cash back, and every Ford in stock, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I threw my script up in the air with him, and I got that job. So for a year, I was his Ford spokesman, national spokesman. I thought, this is not bad. Let's keep doing it. So I went for the Beetleborgs. I didn't throw my script up in the air, but I kind of overacted. I was like a throwback to the 50s, you know, when people were really, really big. Now they play it a little closer to the vest. You know, if you even smile, that's too much. You know, the comedy today, I can't stand it because we were really big with their comedy, you know, and made people laugh, belly laughs. And so I did it. And the producer looked at me and said, and he was being sarcastic. He said, "Could you take that up a couple notches?" He said, because I was way over the top. He said, "You're perfect." So I got cast for Beetleborgs by just going crazy. So you got to bring something different to the table. I mean, literally, coming in the room as the character. I've done that. Leaving as the character. Don't walk. A lot of the guys run out of the room. I've watched them with their tail between their legs. Like, they can't get out of the room fast enough. Saunter out of the room. You own that room. You know, be confident. I always tell my students that, you know, don't be meek. Don't be, you know, like gruff and surly either. Don't make them mad at you. But, I mean, you can smile, but be that character coming into the room.
Right.
Even if it's a rough, tough character, you know, be friendly, but come into the room as the character. Don't just say, "Are you ready? Okay, well, okay, I guess we'll start." You know, they don't want that. They want that person. And so it's just, you know, it helps. So anybody's listening out there, that's the way to get the audition. So it really
helps.
Boy,
yeah.
Because anyway,
with so many people. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No.
All I was going to say was there's so many people going in for those roles that most of the time you have to have something that's at least a little bit different.
Yes, absolutely.
Or they're not going to remember you.
Yes, yes. You need a little bit of difference, and they'll go, "Whoa, wait a minute." You know, because half the time you walk in there, they've already cast it, which makes me mad. Why didn't even cancel the audition? They're eating their lunch. They got their eyes closed. They don't even look up. But if you can do something like pow and wake them up, you know, maybe they're irritated for a second, but they're looking at you. I mean, don't let them get away with that. So Danny DeVito got his role by saying, "Who the hell wrote this shit?" And the writer in the room like, "Whoa." Well, that got their attention. Oh, so don't be meek.
Well, I'm a fan of behind the scenes and, you know, different extra stuff that comes with DVDs. It used to come on a VHS too, but it was always at the end of the tape. But I always love watching that stuff. And one of the things I saw on there for Jeepers Creepers, and a lot of people don't know about this, Jonathan Brack, who played the Creeper, the way that he got the role, he did something that wasn't even going to be in the movie until he did it in his screen test. He came in it totally in character and just started sniffing everybody. And he did it in such a creepy way that people were backing away from him, and people were looking at him like, "This guy's nuts," but he got the part.
Of course.
Because
that's how you do.
Yeah, because I'm sorry, go ahead.
You have to make a bold choice. You know, they talk about that in acting class. Make a bold choice. People don't really realize what bold means. I mean, scare the shit out of them. Or just whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, don't take a pop gun or anything like that. But
right.
But be weird. Don't be afraid to be strange. make them, well, you know, like, it's creepy.
Yeah, that was creepy because they had a video of it, and so they were showing it, and I thought, oh, he just started sniffing people, and then when they said that originally wasn't supposed to be in the movie, but then after he did that, they thought, hey, that's cool, so they wrote that into the movie, how he would go and sniff people. Well, excuse me. So I do want to get into some of your work. Now, of course, we would never get into all of your stuff, no matter how much time we had, because you may or may not be aware, but you have over 200 acting credits on IMDb. So, yeah, we'd need like a whole day.
Just going to mention some, and I've got a story connected to every project I've done. And
I've got some else
to tell. You wouldn't believe
it. Well,
some
if there's
stuff.
Something specific that you want to tell, I mean, you go ahead. You don't have to do what I have planned.
Go ahead. Just letting you know, there's probably something interesting about anything you mention.
Okay. Yeah, because the things I mostly just pick them at random, or because I like the title, or it's something I've seen, or you know. But it's mostly by random. You did a lot of guest spots, and you did a lot of TV. Well, maybe not a lot of TV movies. I mean, now you have, but before you did the Women's Club, it wasn't that many, but you had done some TV guest spots and some TV movies,
right. And
then you were in the Women's Club. Now, do you consider that movie to be like the beginning of your career?
That is my breakthrough role, yes. That's what I always say. That's the one that launched me. And until that time, I was, you know, struggling because I just became an actor in 85. I did commercials.
Right.
I was very popular in print. Now, a lot of people don't know what print is. That is the magazine equivalent to a commercial on television.
Right.
So you're holding up a can of something, and, you know, you just freeze, and they take a picture. You're in a magazine. But people nowadays, what's a magazine? You know, nobody knows. But in those days, I was probably the most, the hardest working actor, at least, and maybe the most working actor of anybody in Denver, and that was the hub of not only national but international print. So I worked internationally. I was a character print model and worked a lot for Scandinavian countries, and a lot of places would come and they would just call me or through my agent. I wouldn't even audition after a while. So I had to give all that up when I moved to Hollywood and start all over. There's a funny story attached to that, too. But I have a book you wouldn't believe. It's really thick about all the things I used to do. I was the Coors host, the bartender, and I did a lot of national truck ads and stuff, too. And Killigan's Red, I think, Killian's Red came out in the 80s, and I did that for Coors. So I did print, I did commercial. There wasn't a lot of film in Colorado at the time, almost none. Student films, things like that. That's why it started out so slow. I did do one called American Flyers. That was my first movie. I was an extra. If anybody remembers that was with Kevin Costner, and
mm-hmm.
Lee Don Chong was in it. And then I did a movie with... called Dream West, right after that, with Richard Chamberlain. I was one of his cavalry officers. I met him 30 years later. There's a funny story attached to that, because in those days, we didn't have cell phones, and we had the cameras you had to thread with the film, and so I didn't thread it properly. So it flopped around in there. Every time I took a picture, it didn't catch. So I get home. I had six pictures with him, and nothing turned out. Oh, I was just devastated. So 30 years later, he's at a convention, and I went over to him. I said, remember me? I got my picture 30 years later. It was funny. But He's pretty much retired now. And then I did one with John Denver, The Christmas Gift. I played a pedestrian that fell into him. That was funny. I got a good picture with him there too. But then I went and did one with John Ritter called Prison for Children, and Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke was 15 years old. Now look at him. My God, he's an A-list actor. He's amazing.
Yeah.
He's just starting out then. He was one of the Prison for Children. He was a juvenile delinquent. And so I was a deputy sheriff. And then the Women's Club came to town with MGM. No, I'm sorry, Warner Brothers. And the director was Sandra Roland Weintraub, one of the Weintraub dynasty. Her father was Fred. His brother was, I can't remember his first name, but anyway, they're very powerful people. Her boyfriend at the time was Scorsese. And when I went in for the audition, I did something different. I started talking to her like a real person. I said, "Oh, you're going to do some skiing when you're up here?" And, you know, it's just chit-chat before my audition. And she kind of liked me. And so she cast me as co-star. Oh, my God. I mean, I'd never even been in a movie as any kind of anything other than an extra. And I'm opposite Maude Adams from Octopussy, Michael Paré from Streets of Fire, Eddie Velez from A-Team, and me. We are the four stars. And I couldn't believe it. But, you know, I did as good a job as I could. I was actually in the movie with my acting teacher, who was very proud of me. That was a thrill. But he was kind of a tough guy. But he was beaming from ear to ear. One of his students, you know, got cast in a co-starring role. So that's what brought me to Hollywood. But before I left, I stayed one more year, and I worked with Perry Mason, Raymond Burr. I did scenes with Raymond Burr, David Hasselhoff, Robert Guillaume. I could go on and on. Gene Simmons from Spartacus, Gene Barry from Bat Masterson, all those guys. And I did three movies with them. Did Father Dowling with Tom Bosley. Did a lot of stuff. And then I moved to Hollywood and did another Father Dowling down here. And then I got a good agent called Film Artist right on Hollywood Boulevard. And I was doing really well for about 3 years. Top of the world, right? Flavor of the month. And then nothing. You're oversaturated. So the wheels fell off. And so I thought, oh man, what am I going to do? So I became a teacher out of necessity. And so that's why I didn't do that much for the next few years. I did stuff on weekends, here and there. My best acting was done on the phone saying, "Oh God, I'm so sick. I can't come in today." You know, when I got an acting job. And so they said, "If we catch you on television, you're fired. You know that." So I had to be very careful, but I got through it. I was a teacher for 22 years, but I acted on the side. And then as soon as I retired, I went back full time, and then I never stopped. But I kept doing it. I did something. I got a guest spot in Arrest and Trial in 2001, and that was a pretty good thing. The problem was, it was about a man who befriended this family and then killed the young son of his best friend. And when I was doing it, I'm playing the guy who kidnapped and killed the son. The father was there watching me, and I turned around and they said, "Well, that's the father." And I went, "Oh, my God." So I didn't know what to do. I mean, what do you do in a situation like that? So I went over to him and I said, "I'm really sorry for what happened, and you know, and I really feel your pain." And so it was kind of an emotional moment for both of us. And so anyway, it was a tough time. You know, you're playing the villain that killed this guy's son, and he's watching me do it with hatred in his eyes. Like, wow. And then I did something called Elvis is Alive. A lot of people thought at the time, this was 2001, that Elvis was still alive. He didn't really die. He faked his death. So there was an ad in the paper saying if you can convince us that you've seen Elvis and interacted with him, you're in the movie. So I thought, well, I've been a skydiver for 30 years. I can convince him of that. So I said, are you familiar with the flying Elvi? They go everywhere, all over the United States. They're all dressed like Elvises. They look like him. And they skydive. And they go into Vegas, you know, and land in the parking lot and all this stuff. He says, I'm one of those. And I taught Elvis how to skydive. And he's impersonating himself so nobody will know where he is. And they thought, oh, my God, that is brilliant. He's impersonating himself. So I got the job. So I got to skydive with the director and gave him some of my best lines. And so I just... anyway, it was fun. Then the Double D Avenger happened in 2001. And that was my next luckiest break. Consider my second breakthrough. Because I was in Hollywood. I was doing stuff. But I wasn't launching myself in Hollywood. It's so tough. It's so competitive. So I met a guy named William Winkler. And he's the one I told you about, the Jackie Gleason type of person.
Yeah.
The name of the character was Al Purplewood, and he was in a movie called The Double D Avenger, which Double D's bra size, right? So it's kind of a booby movie. It probably couldn't get made today, but it was all in fun. It was a bikini movie. There was no nudity, but it was just, you know, just it was kind of a feel-good comedy. And so he owned a strip club and stuff, but you never saw anybody strip. But anyway, people love it. And it'd been all over the world. And so that was like what really launched me in Hollywood. And then after that, it took a while. I was on Son of a Beach for a while with Howard Stern. I did something with him. And then I went on to do some other things, nothing too memorable. Until Mama Dolly. It was a short film, but I acted with Zelda Rubinstein, who was in Poltergeist.
Mm-hmm.
I was sheriff, and I play a lot of sheriffs. I'm going to Oregon next 2 days to play another sheriff. But she was like the big mama of the small town, and she hit a train, and so my deputy tried to arrest her, and I wouldn't let him, and it was a pretty funny bit. So I got to act with her, and... And then I did Beetleborgs. I played the comic book publisher called Rudy McDougal. They wanted me to be a recurring role, but that was the last season, so they didn't do any more after that season. And then I did, what else? I did an Italian film in 1996. I didn't have to fly to Italy. They came here, and I did it in Tombstone, Arizona. And... so that was fun. They all spoke Italian except for me. And I spoke English, and then they dubbed in my voice when I got to Italy. And then a year later, I went back and did a supernatural Western. This was a comedy Western. I did a supernatural Western 1 year to the day back in Tombstone, Arizona. It's very strange. But that was something memorable. That was called A Spasso nel Tempo. Passage Through Time. It's about two of the biggest stars in Italy. They're like Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin. And so they do a lot of comedies, or did do a lot of comedies at the time. And then I did Lord of Illusions with Scott Bakula in 1995.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, I'm kind of jumping around. I did Rocky V. With Sylvester Stallone. I don't know, I'm kind of trying to go from my very first to my very last. And then Bill Winkler wanted me to do another movie, I think in 2006. Let's see if I have it here. It was called Frankenstein versus the Creature from Blood Cove. Do you see it there?
They have it as 2005. That's one that I was going to bring up. And the reason why I had it on my list was because you played Swan Lake on the piano. because you're a piano player. You play all over the world, and you play the sax.
Yeah. Yeah, I printed out my IMDb, but I don't have that one somehow. I missed that page. But anyway, so that one is a very interesting movie. We actually won first prize. We won the grand award at the World's Horror Fest, which is the most premier horror fest in the world. They go every year, it's in a different city, but this one was in San Francisco. And the reason we won wasn't particularly because of me, it was because of the subject matter. He did an homage to the 1930s classic monster movies, and it has never been done. It hadn't been done before like that. It was done in color and then rendered to black and white, so it had more depth of field. And it had a lot of really interesting moments in it. I played a doctor who was half crazy, of course. I didn't play Dr. Frankenstein. I played Dr. Lazaroff, who actually brought back to life. I dug up Frankenstein, brought him back to life, and made him fight to control another creature that had gone out of control that I had created, which was the creature from the Black Lagoon. So I had all the classic monsters in it. I had a werewolf attack me. I had just about every classic monster in that movie. And it was amazing the way he did it. And so they just loved it because it was what they billed it as, a loving homage to the 30s and 40s. And nowadays they make slasher movies and, you know, real gruesome movies. But this was more of kind of a tribute to the old classic, Lon Chaney, you know, and things like that, and Vincent Price. I even did a bit with Vincent Price, the ghost of Vincent Price, when the movie. And so that was very, very popular. And still, you can get it at, I'm not sure where it is now, YouTube, Amazon, things like that, maybe Netflix. So that one was a really good one. And so after that, here it is. It's in actually 2005 it shows. But we won the next year in San Francisco. So let's see if there's anything else that's memorable. Do you have anything that you want to talk about?
Well, I would think that It's a Wonderful City would have been memorable from 2003.
This is something that is near and dear to my heart because nobody really knows this because unless you're a film historian, I look exactly like Henry Travers, and a lot of people, who's that? Well, he looks like me. So you go back, everybody go to your IMDb page and click on Henry Travers, T-R-A-V-E-R-S. He played the angel in It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart.
Yep.
He's the guy that jumped in the water and pretended he was drowning, and Jimmy was around to kill him, and they jumped in his rescue. So I was fortunate enough to look like him. He had a little bigger nose, but that's all. And so then I did that. It's a spoof on the movie. It was kind of a short film for Beverly Hills, like the Planning Commission. Like, what would happen if we let anybody do whatever they wanted with their planning? It'd be a bizarro world. You know, everything would be backwards and, you know, all too crowded. And, you know, all our rights would be trampled on. So it won. It actually won an Academy Award. But it was a different night because it was considered a PSA or whatever. So it was, they do it differently. And then after that, somebody saw that and wanted me to do Ralph's Supermarket. That's a big chain out here in California, similar to Safeway. And so I did it for them, and they won an award. We won a Telly Award for supermarkets. And I played this wacky guy, the angel, again. So anyway, it's been really good for me. And then we were going to take it on the road. The guy who plays Jimmy Stewart, phenomenal. Looks exactly like him. Talks just like him. But the problem is he can't get work because he looks exactly like him. My character, no one knows who he is, so that was lucky for me. But it's tough when you get pigeonholed like that, you know. You can never get work like Christopher Reeves for Superman. He couldn't do anything else. So, anyway, but that was a great one. Love doing that.
Yeah, even today that happens where people get typecast. Even today it still happens. And one of my guests, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, one of my guests that I had on, I don't want to say her name, but she was in a very, very popular TV show in the 70s. And it's one thing to mention it because you can hardly have her or anybody else that was on the show. You can hardly have her on the show without mentioning it. So that's the way I presented it. I said, well, I couldn't really have you on the show without mentioning this. And then that more or less lets the guests know that if they don't want to talk about it that much, they don't have to. And so she talked about it for a little bit, and then we moved on. But I have heard other people that have interviewed her, and all they wanted to talk about was that show that she did in the 70s. Like, yeah. You know, she's been in Hollywood her entire life. She's a tad older than me, and you just want to talk about what she did in the 70s. She's done lots of stuff besides that. Please.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
Oddly enough, I get recognized from music videos. I've done a few of them. And kids are always going, oh, my God, you're the guy in Golden Youth. You're the guy on the roller skates. Like, oh, my God. You know, all the stuff I've done, I'm known for a music video. So it's crazy.
Well, at least they remember you from something.
No, that's true. That's true. It's nice that they do. But because I worked with Bill Winkler, William Winkler, he cast me in his two movies, and then he started doing Japanese animation, which you know is pretty popular. And so I started doing voiceovers. I'd done them. I'd done narration and thing. I was really good at it. And I used to do a one-man show where I'd do like seven different personalities. Jimmy Durante, you know, and good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. And all his friends, Jimmy Stewart and Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn, and you know, I did them all, and then I did like 22 celebrity voices on top of it, and he knew that, and so he cast me in all these old animation things from the 60s, 70s, 80s, like Fist of the North Star, Starzinger, Guy King, and even Ultraman. So I was in a lot of them. Now they're doing the live action feature. It's like half animation, half real people. So I worked in four of those movies. I did 40 of the other classics. So it was good for me. He's very strict, you know, but you got to toe the line. But that's the way it should be. So he's well known for quality work. And so I didn't just get it because he was my friend, but because I, you know, I could do it. And so that was good for me. And he moved to New Jersey now, so we're not really doing it anymore. But I may be doing something in the future, which I can't talk about. So anyway, so I really enjoy the heck out of that. And then my piano playing, you mentioned. I played the piano in Frankenstein versus the Creatures from Blood Cove. I actually played mm-hmm. the piano, and they recorded it on an album. Played Swan Lake, which is an eminent, it's what do they call it, in general domain or whatever it is. So anyway, public domain. So I did that, and I played the Defenders for Frank Sinatra Jr. to sing. I played for him twice for two episodes before he passed away. And that was back in 2010 and 11. And that was a lot of fun to do. And I've played piano in a couple other movies as well, but I really enjoyed doing that. And now I'm posting my performances on YouTube and Facebook, just because, you know, for a while we were all in lockdown, so I had nothing else to do. So
yeah.
I kind of following with that. But I was just trying to cheer people up, you know. I just really
It helps. I have many friends that that's part of what they're doing now is they're posting little things on Facebook, you know, that they normally would make money for, but it's like, you know, what else are they going to do? They have to stay home, and so they do these little ditties, just little ones, and, you know, post it for everybody to hear.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool.
It is. What's his name? Lloyd Webber. I can't remember his first name. Andrew. Andrew Lloyd Webber did a thing. Everybody was, like, shocked. I mean, just out of nowhere. He just posted something. He was playing one of his songs, you know, Phantom of the Opera. And
yeah.
For free. You know, I'd say, here.
Oh, wow.
Great. I wish more people would do that. There was there were a few musicians that did that. But not that many that I know of. And then, for some strange reason, I talk about pigeonhole, right? You get classified or cast in a certain part for a certain role, certain comedy. Like, everybody thought, okay, just by looking at me, because I was fat and funny looking. Okay, you do comedy. Like, it used to annoy me. I thought, well, yes, I do, but I could do other things. But nobody would give me a chance. And then finally, some guy took a chance on me out of nowhere. It was a short film, one of my favorite short films of all time, called Downsize, because it was about a guy who gets the axe from his employer. I mean, they fire him. And all his underlings, he was middle manager, all the people under him were laughing at him. So he kills them all with an axe. And that was probably the most amazing job I've ever done. And it's still out there. You can find it on, I think it's on Vimeo or YouTube, one of those, called Downsized. And people can relate to it because everybody's getting the axe. And nobody can hold their jobs anymore. We're losing it to a robot or just the economy. So, and I did that several years ago. So, I don't know. That was one of my favorite shorts. And then the reason I said that is because he took a chance on me playing a, you know, killer role like that. I went from comedy to horror in one leap, just one film. Then everybody wanted me for horror, and I've never been able to get out of the horror. Now I'm stuck in that. But finally somebody gave me a chance to do drama, and that did very well. So now I've proved I can do anything. Drama, horror, comedy, it doesn't matter. So, you know, it's tough because people won't let you out. Sylvester Stallone tried to do comedy. They hated it. That's a real funny guy. I can't remember his name. He tried to do drama. They wouldn't let him do that. So, you know, it's sad. But you got to produce your own movies, I guess.
Well, that's why so many people do, especially if they're in the indie film business, okay? That's one of the reasons why you want to have your own film company. You can make the type of movie that you want. It can be the way you want it, not the way somebody else wants it.
Exactly. That's right. So now I'm doing that sort of thing with the production team. We pretty much make our own movies. And I can
I'm sorry, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Oh, well, we've done a lot of stuff recently. Like Hollywood Werewolf with James Balsamo, one of the funniest directors I've ever worked with. We have great chemistry, and I've been in several of his movies. And I just did a scene with Andy Dick, who's kind of a celebrity. And he plays.
I love Andy Dick.
You know him? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's hilarious.
Yeah.
In an off-putting kind of way.
Yeah, he's a well-known character here in Hollywood. And then I did Clown Motel 2, produced by Joe Kelly and Angela Joseph. And, he directed it too, Joe did. And so I got a chance to play a very demonic character, which I loved. And I even created my own demonic satanic prayer. Because I didn't have one, and so I came up with one. It's English, Gaelic, and Latin. So I speak a little bit of all of those things, a little bit of English too. But so they were quite surprised that I could do that, because I'm kind of a mellow person, normally kind of passive. And I Oh, I should mention another movie I was in called, they renamed it. It was called Fat Chance because it was full of fat people. But when we wanted to distribute it, they changed it to Camp Massacre. I guess they thought people would be too sensitive about it, but it was more popular as Fat Chance because everybody in it was 400 pounds or more, except for me. I was the nasty drill sergeant. It was a fat camp, and then they all started dying one by one, and they all thought it was me, but it's not me. But I won't spoil the movie, but if you ever get a chance to see it, it's called Camp Massacre. It's hilarious.
Okay.
But when I showed up, in a Hawaiian shirt and kind of like, I'm kind of vanilla personality. It's like, I don't talk very much. You wouldn't know it from right now, but I'm kind of wound up. But normally, if there's more than two people, I don't talk much. I just listen. And they said, you're playing the sergeant, the drill sergeant? You know, the real crusty son of a gun? I said, yeah. They said, we don't believe it. I said, I'm going to make you cry. Wait till tomorrow. They didn't believe it. They were crying the next day. Because I inhabit my characters. Like I said, I'm method. So I was screaming all these obscenities at them and telling them about their mothers and this and that. And, you know, get up off the ground. Rub some dirt on it, you bastard. It's just, and they were like, oh, my God, who is this guy? This is a real person. And so, but I'm authentic. So I don't act. I hate that word. So anyway, so that's another one of my favorite movies. It's called Camp Massacre. But hopefully when they get the rights back, they'll rename it to Fat Chance because that's more appropriate. Then I was in another movie called The Hospital, which is probably the most gruesome movie that ever was. It's been banned in several countries. And thank God I didn't have to do those particular scenes, but I won't even mention what they were. But I play a character in that called Hospital. So that's a pretty rough one. And these are people in Alabama and Georgia. Daniel Emery Taylor was one of the director producers on it. And Jim O'Rear is another one. And I really enjoyed working with Daniel quite a bit. And I still do whenever he needs me. Then I moved on to Lake Erie in 2016. I was the fire chief. Worked with Lance Hendrickson and Betsy Baker. Betsy's known for The Evil Dead. And great lady. And Lance, too. Joy to work with.
Oh, I'm sure.
And hopefully I'll work with Betsy again and maybe Lance as well. They're planning to do another movie called Harvest Moon with Robert Englund. So I've never met him. So I look forward to that. Maybe next year. We'll see. Scheduling is a little tricky right now. But so, I don't know. I did one for Germany called Das Traumschiff. It's the longest running soap opera in the world. It's been on for over 40 years. I played the pawnbroker, and I don't even know how they cast me. They just cast me, and I don't think I even had an agent at the time. They just called me and said, we want you. It's like, what? Do I look German? Or anyway, but I was the only one speaking English. I was a little embarrassed because my grandmother was German, but I never learned a language, so I was like out of my element. But they wanted a guy that spoke English, I guess, that looked a little Germanic. So we shot here in L.A., and the soap opera is about a ship that goes around the world with its passengers. And so anyway, I called everybody in Germany that I knew and told them to watch for that. That was funny. And done a lot of crime stuff. I did something called The Vamps Next Door. This is still running. It's a little comedy, kind of like if you're familiar with the series What We Do in the Shadows about vampires. It's a comedy, and it's all about vampires next door. So I play the Peeping Tom, neighborhood watch guy. His name is Fred Peepers. So I gave him the idea from my name from Wally Peepers back in the 50s. Remember that guy? And But anyway, and then before that, I play this real old guy. You know, I kind of slump over and I shuffle my feet and do the old, all that old stuff. And it's really funny. And before that, I played another one called Ageless, where we helped kidnap somebody out of a old folks home, get her out of there, and set her free. But that never got picked up. And then now there's something on TV called assisted living. I think they stole our concept, but you know, that's Hollywood.
Yeah, it is.
We just don't have the right connections, but. Anyway, between the Ageless and that other one, I really enjoy doing both of them. I like playing like older than I am, like 85. So I just did something with Hollywood Werewolf, the New York accent, kind of an old, cranky, curmudgeon guy, and it was pretty funny. But so each project I have is so totally different from the one that I did before, and it's so much fun to play a different character and different concept. So it's just,
what about, anyway. I like this title, so that's why I picked this one. The Deceased Won't Desist.
Oh, I just finished that. I play, let me just tell you the setup on it. It's about a guy who passes away, right? He's clever enough to make videos to leave behind him. So he has somebody helping him, his mother, actually, and somebody else. And everybody that's ever offended him in his life is invited to his cabin to read the will. So he gets him up there and he tells him, you probably think I'm going to leave you with the $10 million, but actually, you're all going to die, except for one of you. And so slowly, one by one, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but it's a great movie. It's a drama, it's a mystery, it's a comedy, it's all rolled into one. I play the pedophile priest, which I didn't really want to do, but, you know, I finally succumbed to the pressure. I got the role, and so, of course, I get killed too. But so it's all these wicked, wicked people that poetic justice, right? He exacts revenge on them. And it's all through tapes. It's all through, and I don't know, still trying to wonder how he works this out. Like, you're almost talking to him. But he's done it before he died. So it's like, it's mostly a lecture, you know, to each one of us. And then sometimes all together. But it's up in a cabin in the mountains above Los Angeles. It's called Los Pinos, up in the pine trees. It's a beautiful setting. But, you know, we had to do one of our last scenes during the virus outbreak. So that was scary. But, you know, we wore a mask and, you know, we observed the protocol. But it was still probably one of the earliest film projects. So it was a little nerve-wracking, but nobody got sick. So, all right. But it's great, great movie to see. And this director I've never worked with before, but he's done so much. He's done like 14 movies that probably not a lot of people know about. So he should know. His name is Mark Piro, P-I-R-R-O. And the name of his production company is Piromont. It's kind of clever. Like Paramount?
Yes.
But Piromont. So Mark Piro. And he does comedies, kind of comedies with a message, and dramedies too. And they all have this philosophical message inside of them. It's kind of cool the way he does it. So this one has one too. Has a big surprise ending and a lot of twists and turns. And really enjoyed working with him. So that was one of my latest ones. And then I did another one. I was a demon from hell. Which one was that? That was called something about hell.
Journey to Hell?
Journey to Hell. There you go. And I played a real demon. And I wore a robe and a cowl, you know, and I cackled a lot. And they had me in face paint. And that was enjoyable. We did it in a studio in Hollywood. And so look for those coming out. So I don't know when that'll be out, but probably very soon. But one of my favorites is Hollywood Werewolf, because I get to play the saxophone, which I was very good at when I was 16, 17, 18. But I put it down, and the director said, "You play any musical instrument other than the piano?" I said, "Yeah, the sax." "Well, get it out." I had to practice a little bit, and he said, "I want you to know a couple tunes by memory." And they have me playing the sax in an alley, and I play this sleazy manager of an actor who's kind of a has-been, or maybe a never was, but he thinks he was. And he's very funny, very arrogant. And so he becomes a werewolf. And so I have some very funny scenes with him, and some good scenes with the sax in an alley when the moon is full. And we had a problem with a guy downtown, because I was playing at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and this guy comes out of his room and he says, "What the hell are you doing? You're waking everybody up." I guess 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He says, "And this guy sucks," pointing at me, playing the sax. "I know I'm not that good anymore, but I'm a musician and you suck." I said, "Well, I used to be pretty good. It doesn't matter now." But it didn't offend me, because I know I'm not that good. But the whole concept was to make people laugh. And now I'm going to get the sax out and practice more and get good again. So anyway, it's got some really great people in it. Al Burke, who is a professional wrestler, he's in it. Mm-hmm. And I think Andy Dick. I've been in a couple other ones with the director, with Eric Roberts, believe it or not. And done some cameos and stuff in these movies. He's done over almost 600 films now. So,
yeah.
Incredible. Just keeps going. So Clown Motel 2 was, like I said, a real adventure. We were out in the middle of the Nevada desert. We went to Tonopah first, and then a caravan down to past Las Vegas to a little town called Boulder City, out in the desert, about 40 miles east of there, to another town called Benson, just south of there, right above Lake Mead. There's a cave system, and that's where we were doing most of our scenes, in the cave, for that particular section of the movie. And so I did my scenes there as the high priest. It was a ritual priest. I was probably the most evil of all the clown. All the clowns are, if anybody's afraid of clowns, don't go see this movie, because it'll scare the daylights out of you. It's even worse than you can imagine, because these guys are evil. And I'm the most evil of all of them. So, but I kind of hide in my cave most of the time. So I had some great scenes in that, and I enjoyed being very dramatic in my role. So there's just so many things. I mean, my God, I don't know.
Well, yeah, and you've got so many things that are coming out, and you've got so many stuff that you've already done like years ago. That's why I said right at the beginning, we couldn't cover it all in three hours even.
Right. I'm just trying to summarize. You know, the reason I wanted to do the recent TV series, Perry Mason, is because I worked with the real Perry Mason, the original Raymond Burr. And so I got on this thing, and I actually got, a featured role in one of the episodes, actually two of them, with the lead actress that was playing the missionary lecturer, Tatiana, I can't remember her last name, but that was fun, because it was like full circle 30 years from the original. And so that was very satisfying. And other than that, I just done a lot of stuff. And I do Little Stinkers with my daughter. We co-host and review. We're critiques like Roger Ebert and Gene Haskell. And we review movies for children, for their parents. Should you see this movie or should you not? And it's called Little Stinkers. And so it's if the movie stinks, it registers high on our stinkometer. And
I had that one on my list, but go ahead.
It's pretty fun to watch. You know, it was given to me, you know, to do by a friend of mine who does the Indie Cafe, Jonathan A. Moody and Paul Presenza, and they're on opposite ends of the country. But they do their own stuff, you know, they do a lot of stuff. So if you check out Indie Cafe on YouTube. And so they said, would you like to do Little Stinkers? And said, sure, I'd love to. So I convinced my daughter to do it, and so we did it, and we've done 5 episodes, and got one more to go this year, and a hiatus for a while, and then maybe next year start again. But they select the movie, and there's stuff that normally would just hate. There's only been one that we kind of halfway like out of all of them, so it's easy to, you know, to be a little critical. But we start with our cat. We have this black tuxedo cat with a white breast, you know, and she's our little stinker. She's always dressed for dinner. She's got the tuxedo. But we hold her up and say, this is our little stinker. Welcome to Little Stinkers. And I try to make it fun and funny. So I script it out, and then we have, you know, moments where we're just talking back and forth. But it's a lot of fun to do, and especially with my young daughter. And it gives her, you know, a chance to be out there and be seen and stuff. And we do vaudeville, too. I brought back old vaudeville. We do it all over town. We do, like, a song and dance act. We do the Cowboy Poetry Festival every year. And we do other things as well, anything and everything that'll have us. We do, a little song and dance and comedy act. So I'm bringing back vaudeville, sorry. So, I didn't want to let it die completely. So, anyway.
Well, no.
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do poetry as well. So I do poetry things, and I published a book of poetry called Here Lies Madness about things that we take for granted that we don't realize, you know, it's just a little crazy. And so it's like a second look at something we just ignore or don't really think about. And so that's done pretty well. I won an award from Vincent Price back in 1986 for my poetry. And so on the strength of that, I published a book. And I, you know, speak whenever I'm asked to and do a poem or two. And so I even still write, you know, and do stuff, try to do stuff, meaningful poems about being bullied and, you know, this and that. And it was pretty well received. And I do funny ones and serious ones. And so anyway, the book was out for a while, but I pulled it back because it wasn't represented that well. But I'll start again. Just so many things you can do in a day. It's just, I just have to do certain things. My acting's taking a priority right now. So, but it's labor of love. So I just keep doing it.
Yeah. That's funny because you touched on quite a few things that I had on my list, so I don't even have to mention them because you already did. But one thing I did want you to talk about, and we've got like 6.5 minutes left. You have a TV radio show called Underground Hollywood that's actually shot in a cave.
I don't know why I missed that one. I did that for a year. I worked with a director. I wrote it. I produced it. He directed it and acted in it as well as I did. We did like an opening montage where we did some little skits and stuff, and it was so funny, like about a guy who discovered an underground world. There used to be a place right near my house here. It's all fenced in now, but it was an old military base. It had these huge doors, you know, like 20 feet high, steel doors. Mm-hmm. And so I'd pretend to go in them. And behind each one of them was an unknown actor, author, singer, writer, anybody that's in show business or as an artist that nobody knows about. And I had a radio show at the same time, so I did them simultaneously. I did we had a TV station, Channel 10, I think it was, and then I did my own radio show. At the time, there was a radio show just starting in 2000, I think, that it went all over the world that way. It was a computer type of radio show. And so it was a kind of a foreign concept to me, but I learned it to be a disc jockey and stuff. I took lessons from them, and so it was kind of a school at the same time. But then I graduated and started doing it, and I'd invite musicians in, and we'd play their albums and talk and interview, and nobody knew about them. So I'd say, do we allow them to come out into the light of day, or should they bask in the underground forevermore, or something like that? You know, I had this pattern that I did, and we had this really cool soundtrack that this guy did for us. It was like banging rocks together, but with a beat, mm-hmm. like a caveman would do, like clack, 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 clack. But it was really well done, and I loved doing it. And we only did it for a year, and my friend pulled the plug. He was the executive producer on it. He pulled the plug on that, and then we just didn't have the circulation that we wanted, and so I pulled a plug on the radio show too. I said, a year's enough. I'm going to walk away now, but I always regret doing that. Maybe I should go back to it, but I don't have the time. But I'd invite anybody and everybody who needed exposure, you know, and give them a chance, give them a shot, because people don't really get it. You know, they just, it's so hard. It's so competitive in Hollywood. And so anyway, it was well received with the people who needed that exposure. And so I kind of enjoyed doing it. I like helping people. That's why I became a teacher, too.
Yeah.
So that's anything else?
That's one thing that's nice about the indie film business is that's the kind of thing that they all do. They get their friends, and especially ones that may not have as much notoriety as other ones. They say, well, here, come on, and I'll give you a spot in this. Everybody needs to start somewhere.
That's true. Very well. Very well put. A lot of people complain, you know, like there's too many people. You know, the good thing about it is anybody can make a movie. The bad thing about it is anybody can make a movie. But, you know, I mean, everybody's got to start somewhere. You got to look at it from their point of view. You know, a lot of people complain because it's hard to separate the wheat from the chaff. You know, there's such a glut out there. But you, like I said about the auditioning, if anybody's listening here that's a new filmmaker, you have to create a hook. You have to pull people in. You have to have an edge. You have to do something special. Like Chris Christopherson, when he was trying to break into singing, he flew his helicopter and landed on Johnny Cash's lawn. He almost got shot, but he got noticed, and he became a star. So get off the couch, jump off that cliff, grow your wings on the way down. Just do it. Who was that early filmmaker? Roger Corman used to say the same thing. I'm probably quoting him, actually. He said, get off the damn couch, jump off the cliff, and grow your wings on the way down. And he's right. So, you know, just do it. So, I mean, some of you will make it, some of you won't, but at least you'll have fun trying, you know. Everybody has
to. And even if... Go ahead.
Huh? No, everybody has to dry their wings.
Yeah, exactly. And, well, like what I try to tell people, we've only got like a minute and a half, but I try to remind people, just because you don't think it's very good doesn't mean people don't like it. Because one of the guys that I had on my show, he was saying how, you know, he thought that his first movie was really bad. And I watched it, and it was a hoot. I really liked that movie. And I can have a unique look at things because I critique movies. I'm a semi-professional reviewer, critic, whatever you want to call. And so I like to do that. And I gave him a pretty high rating for it, and he couldn't believe it because he thought it was a piece of crap.
It's great. It's always a nice surprise if people like your stuff. And I've been in some real stinkeroos, but you know, somebody somewhere always likes them. You know, it's a good movie to have a beer with.
Well, and if it makes you laugh, especially if it's not supposed to be funny, that's the best kind.
Yeah, I know.
If it's not,
when we did Double the Avenger, we had that in mind. You know, we were laughing ourselves. You know, we were making fun of ourselves. So we didn't take it seriously. It was supposed to be something you laughed at. So, anyway.
Well, we've only got like maybe a little over 10 seconds. Is there anything that you would like to say in closing?
Oh, God. Well, just thank you so much for having me on your show. I sure appreciate it. I have so much to share with the world, and I just want to reach out. And, you know, if I can motivate anybody, you know, I've done my job. So, but anyway, I sure thank you for giving me the opportunity.
No, well, thank you for being on the show. And anybody that's interested, you can contact G. Larry Butler on at least through Facebook. That's one of the things I know about. And we really don't have time to say anything else because they will cut us off in about a minute, even if we're not done. So thank you very much for being on the show, and stay safe and have a good afternoon, evening, whatever it is for you.
Oh, you too. Happy Halloween. And
thank
look for
you.
My Halloween piano solo. I'm dressed in a robe and a cowl and playing, a Funeral March of the Marionettes. So.
Oh, cool.
Okay. Okay. Take care, Max. Thank
you
so much.
Thanks. Okay. Bye. Have a good night. Bye.
You too. Thanks.